Hey there, I'm David Lazarus, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of March 7th, 2014. Great to be with you again. On today's show, tax season is upon us. Heads up, everyone. We'll run down some of the new rules you need to know if you own a home. Also, we'll look at the limitations of career networking for minorities and the changing consumer landscape for music lovers. And of course, we'll tackle your tough money problems. First up, though, cutting the cord is all the rage these days, and plenty of companies are coming up with devices to help the huddled cable masses breathe free. One of those companies is Aereo, and it's in the middle of an ugly legal battle, one going all the way to the Supreme Court. Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech, is here to tell us about it. Hi, Ben.
Hey, how's it going, Dave?
Good. So, Aereo, what is it? It's not a cookie, I'm guessing.
It's not a cookie, but it is delicious for some. Aereo basically takes the place of rabbit ears for your television. We all remember having those. It's a way for people without cable or a physical television to watch live TV. So think PBS, our favorite, the Olympics, the Oscars, things like this. The company allows you to use or rent a dime-sized antenna that they house in a warehouse and turn into actual online streaming content so that we can watch, you know, any of these things over the internet on our devices, on our computers, et cetera, et cetera. They also have a DVR function, so you can actually record that Seinfeld episode that is airing on television at one of the networks at night, and you can watch it later.
In other words, these aren't cable channels. This is live, local, broadcast television that you're able to stream over your device and thus do an end run around broadcasters or do an end run around the cable company, the satellite company. I imagine that the broadcast world isn't thrilled about this.
No, they are not thrilled. In fact, they are livid, and they have been suing and, you know, trying to stop Aereo from expanding into a bunch of cities that it's in now. Aereo has actually won a lot of these court cases. It's been expanding. Broadcasters really don't like it. Aereo is in New York. It's in Boston. Most of these places, it's actually won legal battles. Of course, the broadcasters say what Aereo is doing amounts to an illegal rebroadcast of their content. The COO of News Corp, actually, Chase Carney, has actually threatened to remove Fox's broadcast signals entirely if Aereo is allowed to keep doing what it's doing. And so I guess we'll have to wait and see in April when one of these cases actually goes to the Supreme Court.
Now, the Aereo side of this would be, well, they're broadcasting it free over the air. All we're doing is grabbing that signal, which they are throwing out for free, and then sending it down a different pipe. Obviously, the industry says otherwise. What does the White House say?
This week, the United States Copyright Office put out a brief that supports broadcasters and actually says that what Aereo is doing is retransmitting broadcast content to the public and that it should be obtaining licenses from the broadcasters to do so.
Well, the cable company has a legal obligation to retransmit this stuff. Why can't Aereo make the same claim?
Well, that is going to be the claim that Aereo is going to make. And this is the claim that has actually won them many court battles in states around the country. I've talked to the CEO of the company, Chet Kanoja, and that's basically what he says. He says, look, the government mandates that you should be able to pick up these broadcast signals on your television with an antenna. Now, it used to be rabbit ears or, coat hanger or what have you. Now it's actually a digital antenna. But nonetheless, Aereo says, you know what? You're supposed to be able to do this as a user, and because of that, we're legally sound in what we're doing. We are renting out antennas to individual users. We're not, you know, rebroadcasting to a large group of people. We're doing it one at a time, and there's a legal standing for that.
And is there a threat to the broadcast model? For example, am I able to skip commercials and such?
Well, that's the whole thing, right? If you record with Aereo's DVR function, you could potentially skip commercials. You could pause. You could watch things not live, but later in the day, et cetera, et cetera. And that may be a problem for them as they're making their argument.
So next month, this case is scheduled to go before the U.S. Supreme Court. Any idea which way that's going to fall?
When an office of the U.S. government releases a brief that sides with the broadcasters, it doesn't look good for Aereo. But at the same time, like I said, Aereo has won a lot of these cases. So if the justices look at previous cases, maybe it'll go for Aereo. But if the justices look at what Aereo is doing and look at the complaints of the broadcasters and say, you know what, you're not doing this above board, then it'll go towards the broadcasters.
And we'll see what the Supreme Court has to say about it. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you so much for joining us, Ben.
Thanks, Dave.
The conversation never stops here at Marketplace Money, and our social media maven, Raghu Manavalan, is always watching. It's kind of like the NSA about our show on social media. There is a lot of buzz about cutting the cord. So what are people saying about getting the cable company and the satellite company out of their life?
Yeah, so I decided to ask our community, how much money are they saving? What did they miss? What don't they miss? At Luke BK says, we cut the cord from DirecTV and saved $100 a month. Don't miss anything now that I'm used to it. At Poppy4481 says, I've saved and haven't missed a thing with Aereo, Hulu Plus, and Netflix. I've watched more broadcast TV than ever. I really tried to find anyone that did not like cutting the cord and what they missed. And the only things people brought up were things like live TV, the Oscars, HBO, sports. So if Aereo can get through these cases unscathed, it could be a really big plus for these people.
But no one would ever cut the cord for Marketplace Money.
I hope not.
Thank you very much, Raghu.
Thanks, David.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. We're about a month out from the tax filing deadline. Don't let that sneak up on you. There are some new rules out there for homeowners, and we have Marketplace reporter Nancy Marshall-Genzer here to offer some tips on how to maximize those deductions. Hiya, Nancy.
Hey, David.
Okay, it's that time again for everybody. Tell us about the biggest tax deduction out there for homeowners.
David, the interest on your mortgage, that is the biggest deduction for homeowners. You can deduct every penny you pay in interest. It's not just a percentage of your loan. Now, David, there is one caveat, which is you can't deduct the interest you pay if your loan is more than about $1 million. Now, you can also deduct points. If you paid any points to get a lower rate on your loan, that's deductible. And the way points work is you get you pay an upfront amount to get a lower rate on your loan. A point is usually 1% of your loan. So say you had a loan of $100,000, 1 point would be $1,000. You pay that, you get to deduct it the year that you pay it. It's a little more complicated if you paid points when you refinanced your loan. You usually have to spread that deduction over the life of the loan. And another thing, last thing to know, some taxes that you pay are deductible, which sounds kind of weird. But if you pay a local property tax or local school taxes, those are deductible, but you have to deduct them the year that you pay them.
All right, that's all good to know. Well, what if I happen to be a 1% or even a 2%? Are there any deductions for second homes?
You would be very lucky. And yes, there are. The interest on a second home is deductible as long as that second home has cooking, sleeping, and bathroom facilities. So guess what, David? If you have an RV or even a boat, as long as it has a kitchen and a bathroom and somewhere for you to crash, you can deduct that interest.
Sweet!
But there is one other little detail, which actually is pretty major. You need to actually live in that second home for at least 2 weeks per year.
What, on the
so
boat?
It has to actually be a second home. Yeah, that'd be nice, right?
Yeah, I could live
or
with
in
that.
An RV, toodle yeah. around. And you have to be able to prove to the IRS that this is actually a second home for you and not just a place where you sleep occasionally and rent out for the rest of the year. I talked with Kay Bell of Bankrate.com about this.
You need to be able to keep records of it and show the IRS that you're spending time in there as a second home, where you have to really be careful that you're not renting that out more than you're using it for a second home.
So tell me if there are any deductions that I'm going to lose, deductions that might be expiring that you could take in 2013, but not this year.
Yeah. One of these deductions that expired last month is the tax credit for energy efficiency improvements, things that you do to make your house more energy efficient. I asked Kay Bell about this, too, and she says for 2013, you could get up to a $500 tax credit for some pretty standard improvements.
energy efficient windows, adding some insulation, or if you got a new heating or cooling unit that was energy efficient, that also, the cost of that also could count.
And David, if you made some energy saving improvements in 2013 and you're not quite sure that they qualify for the tax credit, just go to Energy Star's website for details, and that is energystar.gov. One other tax deduction is expiring. It's the tax deduction for private mortgage insurance. And that's the insurance that you have to buy if you had a small down payment. And that's if you couldn't put down, say, a decent chunk of money, say 20% of the price of your home, lenders will make you buy mortgage insurance so they can be sure they'll get paid if you, for some reason, stop paying on your mortgage. The premium for this insurance was completely deductible in 2013 if your income was less than $100,000 a year. If you made more than that, you got a smaller deduction. But 2013 was, unfortunately, the last year for this deduction. Both of these deductions expired the end of last year. Congress could renew them, but hasn't so far. And don't hold your breath.
What if I'm selling a home? Any tax tips for that?
Yeah, actually, you can deduct the cost of advertising or marketing your house. And you can also deduct the cost of certain repairs if they were made within 3 months of the sale. And if those repairs were done to make the house more attractive for buyers.
So, Nancy, stormy weather is the order of the day in lots of the country. Does that affect a homeowner's taxes at all?
Yeah. Here in the Mid-Atlantic, we had snowstorms in the Midwest, ice in the South. If you did have some weather-related damage to your home, you may be able to deduct that. The IRS says you need to have a loss greater than 10% of your income. So, for example, you earn $100,000. You would need to pay $10,000 out of your pocket before you could claim any kind of deduction. Be careful about this. It can be a red flag for IRS auditors. None of us are eager to get audited, but if you have the paperwork, you can claim this.
That's okay. I'll be on my boat.
Enjoy.
Thank you so much, Nancy.
You're welcome.
And you can check out Nancy's tax tips for homeowners at marketplacemoney.org. Coming up next on Marketplace Money, personal finance expert Louis Barajas joins me to answer your money questions. And later on in the show, the king of partying himself, Andrew W.K., stops by to give a wave of his scepter.
The word party is the simplest and most direct and, from what I can tell, understandable word that everybody gets as having fun and celebrating not being dead.
The personal finance of partying on Marketplace Money from APM. All right, time for me to put on my board shorts and jump into the listener pool because it is listener question time, which, as you know, is my favorite part of the show. And to help me out this time, because too much for me to handle, you could say, I'm joined by my friend Louis Barajas. He is founder and chief wealth planner at Louis Barajas Wealth Management. Hiya, Louis.
How you doing, David?
Good. Chief Wealth Planner. God, that's a scary title.
Why is it scary?
It's just you're out there planning wealth. It's like world domination.
That's what it looks like, and that's what it is.
Okay, then.
That's what it is.
Hey, dude, tax season is like right here, and you're out there on the front lines. I know you're not a CPA, but you are a CFA.
Well, I'm an EA, which is an enrolled agent, someone who's actually a specialist in taxes. Okay, so I don't do a lot of tax returns because I do more tax planning, but what we're looking at right now is that I'm seeing people who are doing their tax returns are getting really lazy with their paperwork.
OMG.
And they're not taking the tax deductions that they can normally take. And so what's happened, they're just kind of getting their 1099s, W-2s to the accountant. And then I'm sitting there reviewing a tax return that has been done by a CPA. And I'm looking and say, hold on a second. You're missing all these other deductions. I know. I don't have time to look for them. Take the time. You're going to save yourself a lot of money right now.
And then get your returns in ASAP.
That's what, right?
I say. Let's turn to the phones, and our first caller is Mary calling from Chicago. Hiya, Mary.
Glad to be on the line.
We're using lots of acronyms today, so feel free.
Okay. I hope I can think of some good ones.
How are things in Chicago? What's new with you?
Oh, things are good. Things are cold, and the sun's out, but it feels like it's -5, but hopefully it's going to warm up soon.
Ah, nice balmy -5.
Yes.
So I understand you've got a question about retirement. What are we looking at?
Yes. Me and my husband, we are approaching 50 years old, and I recently left municipal government to take a job at a small not-for-profit. And I'm concerned because we've had a tough time during the recession and had to drain most of our savings and retirement. And so my question is, as a long-range strategy, should I think about returning to municipal government because I was there for over 17 years and would have the opportunity to pay back my pension? And so even if I stayed 10 years, I could, you know, leave government with, you know, 25 to 30 years of service and have something in retirement, because we don't have anything right now.
Let me ask you a question about that. When you had to start dipping into your pension, what were you thinking?
Our family was hit hard by the recession, so my husband was unemployed for almost 4.5 years. And in that time, we gave birth to twins, and we really needed money to both pay for medical expenses, because there were a lot of expenses associated with their birth, and we wanted to be able to keep our house and have some child care, and so it was really out of necessity.
Anytime you're dipping into your pension, or any retirement fund for that matter, you are basically robbing the future to pay for the present. And that's a thing. And you're not alone. I mean, as we went through these tough times, a lot of people had to make these tough choices and look at the short term versus the long term. So you should not kick yourself in the least about having done that. And I want to give you big props for now thinking about what to do about it now that the money is starting to come back in. So first of all, milk and cookies. Feel good. Okay. So
okay, good.
Good. That's our starting point.
I needed
for this
to hear that. Thank
milk
you.
And cookies for everyone. Now, Luis Barajas, you heard Mary's situation. What does she do to try to rebuild that nest egg?
Well, listening to Mary, I think we need to look at the bigger picture, right, Mary? So the decision is like, oh my God, I'm already 50. I don't have enough for retirement. But you've got other life-defining moment things that have happened. For example, you left your job, which you probably weren't that happy, because if you did, you went to a nonprofit probably making less. So more likely than not, that decision was made on a work-life balance kind of issue. Yes or no?
Yes, definitely.
Okay,
definitely.
And then you've got kids that are around, you said 4.5, 5 years old?
5, yeah.
And you're around 50? So mm-hmm. Your kids will be going into college probably around the same time that you're going to be retiring. 65.
I just fell off my chair. Right?
And so all these things are starting to mount. So if we start looking at the bigger picture and say, look, one of the most important things that we need to focus on is what's important for you. What are you trying to really accomplish? What's your ideal outcome? But when you're sitting there with your friends who maybe have kids, like I'm 52, but I've got a 27-year-old, a 23-year-old, and a 21-year-old, and they're pretty much done with college.
Right.
Now I can focus on retirement. Now you've got this double-edged sword that you've got to deal with. And so the other things that we're looking at, besides your retirement, I'll get there, I promise you, is,
thank you,
is that, you know, we've got to think about life insurance. You said your husband just went back to work. So mm-hmm. I'm thinking about, have you done a tax projection? Because now you've got two incomes. I'm thinking about, has an estate plan been done? All these other, you know, issues that will make and strengthen your financial foundation. And so do you then at the same time say, do I quit my nonprofit job, go back to work, maybe work longer hours, have a lot of stress, not be able to spend time with my kids for the sake of just retirement? Remember, you still have plenty of time.
Right.
And then your husband started a job that I hope is making decent money, and he'll have a 401k to participate mm-hmm. in. You also said you're working for a nonprofit. Nonprofits have 403b plans, retirement plans. So I don't know if you're participating there now.
I am.
Okay.
In a small amount, but I could definitely grow that.
Okay. So I don't want you to make the decision like it's just a silo, just one decision based, and not take into account all the wonderful other areas of your life that are going on and other areas that need financial tending to.
But, Lewis, you're tap dancing around the key issue here. She's 50. Clock is ticking. She's drained her pension. And now she faces the difficult task of rebuilding. Does she put money back into that public pension or not?
Remember, the decision is just not a financial decision. It's there's quality and there's quantity. And so we're looking at the numbers, but we're also looking at the quality of your life with your children. Somebody who has children later on in life really wanted to have kids. And at the same time, if you give that up to go back to work, and again, she could be saving retirement money at work right now. And also, she's also be putting money into Social Security, which the previous job, she had no money into Social Security if she was working for the city or the county. So you really got to take a look at the numbers and see if they're so overwhelming that it'll catch you up for retirement. So where you used to work, there is a pension administrator. There's an online where you can call, pick up the phone, call somebody, and they can walk you through the figures and take a look at whether that really makes sense to you to make that decision to go back. Because at the same time, they're not going to give you that retirement back. You're going to have to buy back some time. Is that not true? So it's going to end up costing. Buying back that time, it's the same thing as putting money into your current retirement plan. You're going to be putting more money in.
Sure, but a pension is sort of like the brass ring. So few people have them right now that I would be very reluctant to give one up, to be honest.
I agree with you. And again, look at the numbers. But what I want you to do is put things in perspective and look at the bigger picture. Don't make a financial decision just on fear, based on fear alone. So I hate to just say do one or the other, because I don't think that would be the right answer.
All right, Mary, does that guidance steer you in the right direction?
No, it does. It gives me some really good things to think about, and I think looking at the longer view is good. I have hit the panic button, clearly. There's a lot we have to kind of rebuild after this long period, but this gives me, I think, a really good roadmap and a lot of good things to think about.
Good, and don't be passive here. I agree with Lewis that you want to contact that administrator, find out what the actual numbers are here. I mean, get your fingers dirty with this thing. Don't sit around fretting about it. Apply yourself to it. Find out what the actual numbers are. Find out where that money is best going to meet your needs, your goals, and be active with this, okay?
Okay.
And
thank
send
you.
Us an email on what you decide.
I definitely will. I appreciate it.
Good luck, Mary.
Take care, Mary. Okay, we're going to go to a break. Lewis, you can stick around, right?
I'll stick around for sure.
And when we come back, we'll take more of your questions. Marketplace Money from APM. I'm David Lazarus, and I'm back with financial planner Lewis Barajas. Hello, Lewis.
Hello, David. How are you?
Good. We've been going back and forth with some, I think, pretty good advice for our listeners. Next up, we've got Justin calling from Suffolk, Virginia. Hiya, Justin.
How you doing?
Good. So what's new in Suffolk, Virginia?
Well, I was hoping you guys could help me out with how my wife and I are approaching saving for the future, paying down our loans, preparing for a family, and just the right approach and the right kind of mix of where we allocate our money.
Give me a sense right now of what your overhead is. Do you own? Do you rent? What are you looking at the moment?
Sure. We rent a home. We have two cars, one which is paid off, one which has about $10,000 owed on it. But the real heavy hitter that we have are school loans. Combined between us, we've got $165,000.
Jiminy crickets. Where'd you go to school?
Well, I got a grad degree at VCU, but my wife got her doctorate from PCO, and there's a big number there.
So if I can summarize, Justin, you're just basically saying, okay, we're starting out, we're getting serious. What's our game plan?
That is correct. And so far to date, we've been really focused on paying down that debt. Mm-hmm. It started about $225,000 combined between us, and we're at, $165,000 for the school loan. So that's been, that's been our main focus, trying to minimize the amount of monthly payments that we have. And now we're at a point where, we've got some cash back in the bank that we've recouped after paying for our wedding. We've really started to pay down some of those loans, but we don't have a lot in retirement. In my job, I'm actually just eligible at the end of this month to start getting an employer contribution. So we're ramping up for that. But trying to figure out, how much do we put into retirement? How much do we put for loans? How much do we keep saving just so we can have a little bit of a rainy day fund?
All right. And one last question before I bring in Lewis, and that is, all right, what about your income level? Are you guys bringing in some green?
Yeah, we're okay. Combined, we're about $175,000.
All right, you're looking very strong. So, Lewis, a lot of young couples face exactly the questions that Justin is talking about right now. And he's got a good-sized income. The two of them have a good-sized income to deal with. How should they lay it out?
They've got great educations. They've got great income. Yes, they've got a lot of debt, but their future just looks wonderful. It goes back to taking a big picture view of all of your finances. What I heard is that you're probably going to want to be starting a family soon. You're renting. You maybe want to buy a home in the near future. I don't know if you've thought about maybe one of you staying home and not working so much. David, it's just kind of putting all the pieces together and figuring out we can't do it all, or we shouldn't just focus on one. We just kind of start looking at all the pieces and figuring out where our resources should go and where they would have the highest and best use.
You know, normally, and I'm sure the listeners are aware of this, I'm fairly aggressive when it comes to debt. Don't like debt. But when it comes to student debt, I'm more accommodating because it's just one of those things that's common to so many people. And it's just sort of the investment that you made in your future, and it will gradually come down over a very long period of time. And my instinct when it comes to student debt is to not be as aggressive with it as you would be with, say, credit card debt.
Absolutely. I'm totally 100% agreement with you. And again, they're probably earning the income that they're earning because of their degrees that they currently have. So did any of the things ring true to you? For example, maybe one of you staying home a little bit more than not working so much, and you know, if those things ring true, then you need to start building some of your emergency reserves. I don't know how much you have in emergency reserves right now. I don't know what if one of you lose your job. And so the other thing is, if you're going to buy a home, you got to start looking at the numbers, get pre-qualified. How much money am I going to need? Are we going to need both incomes? Can one of us stay home? Do I need more of a down payment? Again, start putting all these things together. And I think that it'll help you clarify really what you're trying to accomplish.
What do you think, Justin?
I think that makes sense. I guess if you can put an actual number or percentage in terms of at what point do you say I've got enough cash that I can start, you know, kind of say I'm good with my rainy day fund. Now I should focus a little bit more on either saving for a house or saving for a child or paying down some of that student loan.
Great. It's not a percentage. I'll do budgets for people who earn $30,000 a year. The budgets will predicate everything else. And let me tell you why. Because I'm gonna tie that budget to your career. So if I know that you're in an industry in which if you lost your job would take you anywhere from 6 months to a year to get that job back, I would have more money in that rainy day fund than someone who's lost their job and can find a job within 1 or 2 months. It's also based on your level of income, based on your fixed expenses. So it's not a percentage. It's more of, I don't want to do this rule of thumb because that's what really gets people into trouble.
But that said, one of the things that can get people into trouble quickest is healthcare costs. So take a look at your healthcare horizon. Make sure that you and your wife are good, especially before you start bringing kids into the equation. And I think it's very important to have enough liquidity on hand to handle any medical mishap that might arise.
Thank you.
All right. Now, every so often, we take a little trip down memory lane and we check in with past callers to see how they are doing. Back in October, we spoke with Jamie in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. I remember this show. I was listening to that one. He worked for 30 years at General Motors. He had $200,000 that he wanted to donate to various charities, which is very cool. And at the time, he was drafting a new will and thinking of starting a foundation. And Lewis, you were on that show. And I remember you were telling him that what he wants to do is work with an established foundation, bring them into the will, do some serious estate planning.
I think I also asked him if he wanted to adopt me.
Well, let's check back in and see how things have gone. Jamie, are you there?
Yes, I'm right here.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
So just to backtrack, so you had $200,000 to play with once upon a time. What you doing now?
Okay, well, I talked with my Fidelity advisor through Fidelity Investments. They handle all my GM pension and all my other investment funds. And he recommended that I check into the Fidelity Charitable Fund, which I did. And I opened up an account there. It was the email from Candace that finally got me in action because it's been on the back burner forever. And so I've been working on that.
And that email from Candace is our producer.
Yes.
So she's the one who lit a fire under you right there.
Yes.
So you're putting that money to work, it sounds like. And
yes.
Are you feeling like that fits in well to your estate planning?
Yes, it does. It's such an unusual situation that I'm in, and that all the money that I stuck away in my 401s and 403s and all of that, it's just kind of sitting there because with what I get from my pension and Social Security that I'll be collecting before too long, I'm living like a king on that.
And I've got Candace shouting in my ear saying, ask him about his brick collection.
Yeah.
What? Hello? What?
Yeah. I collect antique paving bricks and marked bricks. It's really insane.
Well, who doesn't? I mean, Jamie, what is your advice for anyone else who might be sitting on a little bit of money and wants to put it to some good work? What have you learned?
I've learned to go after your passions and what you really feel for. Like, I'm going to be doing a lot of my work with GBLT Youth through the Ellie Forney Center and the Cyndi Lauper True Colors Fund. And I feel they're the underdogs in the world, and they need all the help that they can get. And if you have a passion, just go after it.
Well, I'll tell you, there's one word that comes to my mind, and that's mitzvah. Jamie, it was great talking to you. Thank you very much.
I've enjoyed this, and keep an eye out for some bricks.
You bet you will. We'll put them in an envelope. So, Lewis, I mean, he took your advice and has done well with it. What would you say to others?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that you don't have to be a millionaire to have your own foundation. You can go to these, like, for example, Fidelity, use donor advice funds where you put in money, you can take a tax deduction, and at the same time, you can select the charity that you want. So it doesn't have to, it could be anybody out there who says, I have a certain amount of money, $20,000, that if I want to give it to a specific person, I want to make sure it gets to them, and you can start accumulating money through there and then eventually donate the money.
Do you collect anything?
I don't. Lately, I've been trying to collect my patients, but that's about it.
Yeah, I'm trying to find my marbles. I lost them. Go figure. Lewis Barajas, thank you so much, as always, for joining us. Your insights are always extremely valuable.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Of course, we here at Marketplace Money love to hear from you, the listener. So if you got a money question, head on over to marketplacemoney.org, and you can send us an email, or better yet, record your question, because we'd love to hear your voice. Or, as always, you can tweet us at @LiveMoney. Coming up, rocker Andrew W.K. contemplates money and partying. And speaking of music, how are we buying ours?
I don't see the mainstream consumer wanting ownership of any goods these days.
I'm sure that doesn't apply to collecting bricks, of course. All manner of good times are just ahead on Marketplace Money from APM. The South by Southwest Festival builds itself as a paradise for networking. And that's why everyone from musicians to app developers to bloggers to all the cool kids from school have flocked to Austin this week for the chance to be part of the next big thing and maybe get a paying gig out of it as well. So if the name of the game is networking, does everyone enjoy the same advantages? The jobless rate is significantly higher for people of color. White Americans make up about 6% of the unemployed, while Hispanics and Latinos make up nearly 9%, and African Americans make up 12%, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Thus, if networking is the key to landing a job in this day and age, how does that approach work for minorities? Nancy DiTommaso explores this question in her book, The American Non-Dilemma, Racial Inequality Without Racism. She's a professor and vice dean for faculty and research at Rutgers Business School. Nancy, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you, David?
Very well, thank you. So when I look at these numbers and we put it in the context of networking, it makes me think, well, okay, so white people network the heck out of stuff while minorities aren't quite as proficient, or is that not the right conclusion?
Well, I don't think that that's quite the way that I would frame it. The issue about why unemployment seems to be different across these different groups may not be so much in terms of how much networking people do, but where they are placed in terms of their ability to network in a way that will lead to the kinds of outcomes that are effective in terms of getting good jobs. We still live in a very segregated society. We live in different neighborhoods, go to different schools, and even still work in different workplaces to a large extent. And whites are disproportionately in the best jobs, the highest paid jobs, the jobs with the most training, and also the jobs where people get to make decisions about who gets hired. So I found in the research that I did that 70% of the jobs that people get over their lifetimes came with some kind of additional help. someone who could give them information that other people didn't have, could use influence on their behalf, such as this is my friend, look out for them, or someone who could actually give them an opportunity or hire them for a job. So if Hispanics or Blacks or others have higher unemployment rates, it may not be that they aren't networking, but it may be that they don't have networks that tie them into where there are job opportunities and where people can make decisions on their behalf.
But if such cronyism is rampant, that would suggest that there are white jobs and Black jobs, Latino jobs and Asian jobs that are all being passed along to one's friends and mates. Is that what your research shows?
Well, it's not so much that that's what my research shows, but there's other research that does suggest that there is much less desegregation of jobs than we might believe to be the case. For example, there's a book that just came out before mine by Kevin Steinbeck and Don Tomaskovic-Devy called Documenting Desegregation that uses the EEOC-1 reports. These are the reports that are required for certain employers to report the distribution of people in different kinds of jobs in their workplaces. And they analyzed these data from 1966 to 2005 and found out that whites, particularly white men, not only retained the favorable position that they had in the labor force over this 50 years or so since the civil rights movement, they actually had improved their position in the best jobs. And while there was some desegregation between white men and Black men right after the civil rights movement until about 1980, almost nothing changed after 1980, and that's a very long time. There's been some improvement for white women moving into professional and managerial jobs, but they still are not anywhere near on par with white men, and very little changed for Black women. In fact, there's actually been some resegregation of jobs between Black women and white women as white women's job prospects have improved.
Is it your sense that people are aware of this or that this is a more subconscious trend?
Well, I think that people are not at all aware of the overall trends. I'm sure that that's the case. In terms of the individual experiences that people have, it also seems to be that people do not have a good sense of how their own experiences fit into this larger picture. For example, even though when I talked to people and got these job histories, I found that 99% of the people I talked to got 70% of the jobs that they held with this kind of inside edge. When I asked them after these job histories, so how do you think you got to the place you are in your life? What do you think most contributed to you having the kind of life you have now? They didn't say, because I knew the right people and people helped me. What they said was, because I'm smart, because I worked hard, because I got an education, because I was motivated, because I persisted. So there is this disconnect between how people experience their lives and how they actually go about living their lives.
And that suggests that this isn't going to change anytime soon.
Well, it's not going to change unless there's a tension at a public policy level in terms of how organizations think about the decision-making that takes place within their entities and in terms of, you know, support for changing the outcomes. Everyone that I talk to claim to believe in civil rights. No one thinks anyone should be discriminated against. They all think that equal opportunity is the solution or the fair way to address these kinds of issues. But everybody that I talked to spent their lives seeking unequal opportunity.
Nancy DiTomaso is a professor at Rutgers Business School and the author of The American Non-Dilemma, Racial Inequality Without Racism. Nancy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. Sure, the networking opportunities are great at South by Southwest, and so is the soundtrack. More than 160 bands are hitting the stage in Austin this year, and maybe even one or two I've heard of, although probably not. Seeing a live show is always a blast, but is owning music as important as it used to be? Earlier this year, Billboard reported the first drop in digital music sales since the iTunes Store made its debut in 2003. CD sales, of course, continued their steady decline, and overall album sales experienced an 8.4% dip. We've asked Kyle Bellin to shed some light on the habits of modern-day music consumers. He's a user researcher at Live Nation Labs. Hiya, Kyle.
Thank you for having me.
I throw out all my albums when CDs come around. Then I throw out all my CDs when digital downloads come around. And now I'm wondering, do I bother with digital downloads anymore if indeed I can just stream things anytime I want on Pandora, Spotify, YouTube for that matter?
The music industry as a whole is still determining what the best product is for today's music listener. We don't yet know if people want to pay for unlimited music or if the business models around those companies are viable. 10 years into the digital music revolution, we are still trying to understand whether or not Spotify is a product that people want and if it's something that they will pay for indefinitely. And an increasing number of startups are pursuing direct-to-fan marketing that sells experiences and digital products and physical goods directly to fans through their email. Topspin Media, a direct-to-fan company, they were recently acquired by Beats Music. For the first time, we're going to see an online music streaming service directly integrated with a marketing platform who can look at the behavioral data from the streaming service and allow artists to target their most avid listeners, where the portals where fans listen to and discover music are also the places where they purchase tickets, buy merchandise, and support their favorite artists.
Speaking of supporting musicians, we've been having a conversation with our friends and fans on social media, and all week long we've been asking them to tell us why they do or don't still buy music. Kendra in Berkeley, California, has this to say.
I've actually increased my music buying. A big reason is to support the artists and labels. It's like buying local, only with music.
Is that one of the big drivers now, that you would buy the CD because you are supporting the artist and not necessarily because you want ownership of these goods or this music?
Yeah, I don't see the mainstream consumer wanting ownership of any goods these days.
Do you expect more and more people to buy and or support music financially, or would you expect more and more people to, for lack of a better word, freeload online, and that's the future?
Yeah, I don't see buying and owning music as the path forward in the music industry. It very well may be, when YouTube reveals their upcoming subscription service, that they take a more dominant position in the market because they've taken a free audience who's used to accessing videos through service and converted enough of them into paid subscribers for a streamlined experience.
All right, I get that. Also, how influential is it when a music service, an online service, recommends tunes to you based on other tunes you've listened to? This is a computer saying, Kyle, you're going to probably like this. Does that work for you?
I often don't find that the recommendations go outside of the lines enough to actually make a relevant connection. Certainly, if I want to hear Dashboard Confessional and stuff like it, Pandora is a great way to be exposed to artists that exist in the ecosystem around that artist. But if you want to stay up to date on the latest hard rock or new metal, they don't currently align themselves like with the Billboard charts, in that the newest music is readily available on the service and it's targeted to you, the music fan.
Kyle Bellin is a user researcher at Live Nation Labs, and we know what that is now. Kyle, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking about your music buying habits all week on social media, and some of your comments took us down music memory lane, like this one.
My name is Mavis Gregg. I am an attorney living in D.C. The first piece of music that I bought was Madonna's Material Girl. It was a single, but it was in vinyl, and so to me it was huge. The actual material was huge, and it was so beautiful. And I had this little kid's record player, but I actually wanted to play it on my dad's record player because that was the more mature record player. But I just enjoyed it so much because it was mine, and I used my money to buy it. The first CDs I started buying were through the CD Music Club. I remember seeing the little pull-out cards in a magazine that only cost like a penny plus shipping and handling to get 16 CDs.
Dig!
Red Hot Chili Peppers, Arrested Development, D-Light. Soon after I received my CDs, I wrote the company a letter and let them know that I'm not old enough to be in the club and that I wanted to end my membership, which they did, and I didn't get penalized. I recently started collecting visual art. It reminded me of the pleasure I had in collecting music and how I've neglected that desire. For the last 10 or so years, I've been buying music digitally or subscribing to memberships where you can access the files, but that's not the same as actually owning the music. The only CDs that I purchase are from artists that I've been following for years who tend to be independent artists or artists that are in other countries that I've visited. It's kind of my souvenir for myself to buy music whenever I travel abroad. But I haven't been buying a lot of music lately just because you kind of forget, since you have it available at your fingertips on your phone, on your iPad, on your computer. And so now I've actually been thinking about that pleasure that I feel having it in hand and considering buying vinyl. I don't own a record player, but I think it would be really nice because you get to look at the work in your hands as well as listen to it. And I think it's more like having an art collection too, because it's something that you can look at, that you can touch. That's an added bonus for me as a collector of music.
Join the conversation on Facebook about owning music. Tell us about the first album you bought. Or tweet us your record store memories. We're at Live Money. You know me. My mantra is that you've got to fight for your right to party. But partying and money can be a tough relationship to manage. Here's one rock star who has a great deal of experience dealing with both.
I am not a financial advisor, but I have spent a lot of money and made a considerable amount of money and enjoyed spending it almost as much as making it. My name is Andrew WK, and I'm a professional partier.
When it's time to party, we will party hard.
The word party is the simplest and most direct and, from what I can tell, understandable word that everybody gets as having fun and celebrating not being dead. Fortunately, partying doesn't have to cost a lot of money. There's nothing wrong with spending a lot of money on having fun, but you can certainly spend very little or not any money at all and have a great time. For me, in the older days when I had very little money, just walking around the block and standing on the street corner and watching people go about their lives was quite entertaining for me. Being in New York City, it's a lot to see and there's a lot of stimulation. Back in Michigan, it wasn't as colorful, so you can really get your money's worth if you're paying a lot of rent just to watch the movie of day-to-day life on the street here. But, of course, I also didn't feel bad those few times when I would spend an entire week's paycheck in one night. I figured I got something out of it. And actually, the more aware that I was when I was spending a lot of money on entertainment, the more I made sure to get my money's worth. And it wasn't just the stuff or the experiences or the food or the drink. It was the state of mind that it put me in. And I tried to really hold on to that so that even the next day or the next week, I could still be extracting valuable experience from that party. There's definitely been times when I've spent what I consider to be large quantities of money on unnecessary items, experiences, and whatnot. And I don't regret them, but I wouldn't necessarily do it again. And that means it was a valuable experience because I learned something. I certainly don't have any expertise beyond my own experience, which has taught me to like money and the power that it brings. It is a tool to make dreams come true. It really is. It might not be able to buy happiness, but it can buy the means to have very enjoyable experiences. And there's so many goals and dreams and projects that I've wanted to do, and it would have been physically impossible to do them without money. I've learned now that I haven't learned enough about saving money because my parents, for example, they didn't have as much money growing up, or by my age, I guess, than I have had, and yet they were able to save more than I have myself. So saving seems to be a big step for anybody. And there's that immediate urgency and passion that tells you to not think about 20 years down the road, let alone 50 years. But it does seem that you don't have to be too set into the future in your mindset to still set aside some portion of money. And the way it can double on itself is pretty exciting. I mean, if I had just been saving a few hundred dollars a month since I began my career as a professional partier, I'd probably have at least, well, like a couple hundred dollars. So anyway, yeah, savings is a big one. I'd like to get better at that. And someday maybe I'll save up enough to buy a solid gold car or something. A golden car.
Andrew W.K. is the duly anointed king of partying. You can follow him on Twitter at Andrew W.K. and visit andrewwk.com for all things good times. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, we'll be learning all about you, your money, and your lives, but not in a creepy, stalkerish kind of way. Our show is produced by Candice Manriquez, Raghu Manavalan, and Lindsay Foster-Thomas. Our senior producer is Dan Sematovich. Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm David Lazarus of the LA Times. Remember, always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. And until next time, I'll see you in the business section.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.